It's no secret that Joseph Smith has a sort of dodgy past when it comes to legal issues. No, I'm not going to say dodgy in a British accent again. You're welcome. Now, if you were raised a devout Mormon like me, you would have been taught some of the dodgy stuff, but the way it was framed made it seem like sometimes a prophet had to break the law, or even sometimes the law was just wrong, and breaking it was a sign of civil disobedience. All bright and shiny in that Henry David Thoreau kind of way, of course.
Actually, I was taught that too. So I've been doing these Mormon history rants on TikTok lately because I have no self-control. And sometimes someone will be like, Brigham Young was really good at outsmarting the government. And I say to them, so you mean he's really good at breaking the law? That's what you're trying to say. It's like Mormons take this special pride when our prophets break the law. We are so proud of it.
It's weird. We normalize stuff that outsiders look at and think, that's not something to, you know, that's not a badge of honor, but it's just part of our history and we really kind of like it. And that framing has caused Mormons a lot of problems down the road. When you start out with the premise that breaking the law is okay, as long as your spiritual leaders are doing it, it opens an entire can of worms, and not the good trolley kind either.
Hi, this is Lindsay Hanson Park.
And this is Brian Buchanan.
Bringing you the story of Mormonism from the shadow of the everlasting hills, straight out of Zion. This isn't your grandpa's Mormon history.
Well, I have sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I have sinned so gravely, Brother Young.
This is the tale of Mormon saints and sinners from our roots until present day. Saddle up.
Gird your loins, lock your hearts, and pay your tithing, because we're bringing you the story of Mormonism in all its paradisiacal glory.
It's the Sunstone History Podcast.
Well, I've sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I've sinned so gravely, Brother Young. That only you can save me, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. But only you can save me, Brother Young.
Whenever news agencies interview me about the context of like Mormon fundamentalism, this question comes up. So why are so many so-called prophets breaking the law if you have these Mormon articles of faith that talk about, I don't know, sustaining the law? And I always have to tell them that there's this like funky tension between God's laws and man's laws.
I feel like that's kind of a long story, maybe. We've talked about this before, but in Mormonism's own scripture, the Book of Mormon, there's the story where Nephi cuts off the head of the bad, wicked Laban. Sure, he brutally murders and decapitates this guy, but sometimes, you know, a little bloodshed is required for the good of God. Yeah, it's not really good precedent when your verse starts, better that one man should perish, dot, dot, dot. Whatever's after the dots doesn't really matter.
Oh man, I've said it before and I'll say it again. That one scripture story has done so much more damage toward violent zealotry and Mormonism than any other scripture. I've heard it used to justify all kinds of things.
Excuse me, the one mighty and strong?
I know, Mormon men really want to be mighty and strong, no matter what. Off the top of my head, I'll just name a few of the people that I can think of that have used this to do terrible things. John D. Lee, for example, of Mountain Meadows Massacre fame. Bill Hickman and all of his murders. Porter Rockwell and all of his murders. The Nauvoo Legion and all of their nonsense. Joseph Smith, Brigham Young, Hosea Stout, Jedediah Grant, and so forth and so with. Then you've got the Lafferty brothers, Irvel LeBaron, Samuel Schaefer and the Knights of the Crystal Blade, John Singer, Adam Swap, Warren Jeffs, Lyle Jeffs, Samuel Bateman, and on and on and on.
Mormonism's relationship to the law has always been a little, let's say, squishy. Thanks to Joseph Smith's own complicated relationship to the laws of the land, generations that followed him have had to decide how they were going to interpret the morality of upholding and sustaining the law.
Today, and with the help of Idaho potato clodhopper Brother John Dinger, we are going to cover all the legal issues of Joseph Smith Jr. All of them? Are we going to cover all of them?
Hey,
most of them.
When it's John Dinger, you're going to get some good stuff here. We've got a bit of a debate between scholars and sources on just how many times Joseph Smith actually got in trouble. Some folks will trumpet that Joseph Smith was never convicted, and others are like, he was arrested more than 40 times. And if you can believe the Encyclopedia of Mormonism, he had at least 30 criminal actions taken against him throughout his lifetime, including the one, you know, that actually gets him killed in the end.
That's right. We are working our way up to the martyrdom in Nauvoo, where Joseph Smith is murdered in a gunfight after an angry mob storms his jail cell in Carthage, Illinois, where he was awaiting a trial on charges of inciting a riot for illegally destroying a printing press. Don't worry, we are going to do an entire episode on the destruction of the Nauvoo Expositor very soon. Actually, we have two episodes coming up for that one.
People are like, we haven't done a multi-parter in a while. What's going on? Stay tuned.
Don't worry, William Clayton will only be mentioned seven times.
So, Joseph Smith's brush-ups with the authorities actually predate his Mormon life. Legal scholar and Uncle Rico neighbor, J. Stephen Dinger up there in Idaho, is going to go into this in more depth, but Junior didn't have as smooth a childhood as the movies in the Joseph Smith Memorial Building Theater would have you believe.
That's right. I was actually surprised to learn that he sort of struggled as a kid. We've already talked about how his father, Joseph Smith Sr.'s business, had failed many times and how that contributed to Sr.'s alcoholism. But we don't actually really talk about how it affected his kids. And it absolutely, of course it did. It affected his kids, as anyone that lives in a family with an alcoholic knows. What we do know is that a young Joseph Smith also liked to get hounded on the sauce and would often get drunk and into trouble as a young teen.
So Grant Palmer and a few others have talked about theories that Joseph Jr. sometimes visited brothels and engaged in other forms of sin. I don't know that the evidence on brothels is super convincing, but there are definitely several sources that claim that Joseph was troubled in more ways than one.
Can we talk about the brothel thing for a minute, though? Because, you know, I know it's a scandal to, like, accuse Joseph Smith of visiting brothels. But if we can step back from sort of the truth claims or what that would mean if Joseph Smith did that. I mean, we already know Joseph Smith has what I would say an unethical track record with women. But the brothel thing was part of Victorian culture. There was very much understood that, like, frontier men, that's just what they did, right? So I don't think it's that big of a stretch, even though, but what you're saying is there's not a lot of documentary evidence.
It's hard because in that those early years, we have virtually nothing that's contemporary. And that's a problem because we're relying on all these later sources, both pro and con. And that's what's so hard is you have to sift through them. I mean, we've done this so many times now. Polygamy, you know, all these things where we have not so much contemporary evidence, but later reminiscent accounts. And so in those cases, both sides of the discussion have something to gain by, let's say, being disingenuous.
And I would also like to point out that I don't think a lot of men have left a paper trail when they visit brothels. So documentary evidence is going to fall short on that.
This is true.
But you're right, he got into enough trouble that we do have documents of. For example, as a teen, Joseph Jr. would sometimes get into fights at work. So this is from John Hammond's book, and he records, quote, Gordon T. Smith, Lemuel Durfee's adopted son, related a story about Joseph drinking while the latter was working for the senior Durfee. Joseph's presence at the Durfee farm on at least two unspecified occasions in August 1827 is confirmed in the employer's account book. When Durfee's wife discovered that Joseph had been sneaking drinks from the whiskey bottle in her pantry each morning before work, she switched the bottle for one containing pepper sauce, which caused Joseph considerable discomfort. How do you not tell, by the way, the difference between pepper sauce and, like, whiskey?
I drink Tabasco all the time. I think that's...
Like, is there whiskey, like, thick and muddy water? I don't understand what's happening. No, we know you like spicy V8. You've already admitted that. Anyway, back to the quote. There was no shortage of alcoholic drink at the Smith home during Joseph and Emma's tenancy. One of Lemuel Durfee's account books records the purchase of large quantities of liquor cider by the family during the spring and summer of 1827. Alcohol elicited more than Joseph's anger, for Stafford reported that, quote, when intoxicated, he frequently made his religion the topic of conversation. When inebriated, anything Joseph had tried to repress seemed to bellow up like the steam rising from a doused fire.
This kind of behavior really might explain why Joseph's earliest documented issues with the law, as early as 1826, were for disorderly conduct. And part of this had to do with Joseph Smith's glass-looking enterprise. He was brought into a Bainbridge court by the local constable for being a disorderly person and imposter. The person who leveled the charges was Josiah Stoll's nephew. And the Stoll family dynamics were really interesting because on the one hand, you have Josiah, who was giving Joseph money and seems to buy into what he's doing. But then the next generation are like, Dad, what are you doing with this guy?
There are several accounts of this, but one published much later in 1873 claimed to have access to the court records. Quote, Smith said he had a certain stone which he had occasionally looked at to determine where hidden treasures in the bowels of the earth were, that he professed to tell in this manner where gold mines were a distance underground, and had looked for Mr. Stoll several times and had informed him where he could find these treasures, and Mr. Stoll had been engaged in digging for them, that at Palmyra he pretended to tell by looking at the stone where coined money was buried in Pennsylvania, and while at Palmyra had frequently ascertained in that way where lost property was of various kinds, that he had occasionally been in the habit of looking through the stone to find lost property for 3 years, but of late had pretty much given up on it on account of its injuring his health, especially his eyes, making them sore, that he did not solicit business of this kind and had always rather declined having anything to do with this business. And therefore, the court find the defendant guilty. And then, of course, costs, warrant, 19 cents, complaint upon oath, 25 and a half cents, seven witnesses, 87 and a half cents, recognizances, 25 cents, minimus, 19 cents, recognizance of witnesses, 75 cents, subpoena, 18 cents. A total of $2.68.
It's a bargain. It's an absolute bargain.
Bargain for a crime. I will say this. I love the thought of Joseph Smith. There are accounts of him getting drunk and preaching about God. Like, that's, to me, that sums up Joseph Smith. Like, a young teenage Joseph Smith gets too sauced up and tells you about Jesus.
Well, if dad gets drunk, then he starts putting spells on your gun so it won't shoot, right? So they had a history of interesting drunk behavior, it sounds like. All right, so all these things we've talked about, just a sampling. We'll let Mr. Dinger regale us with the rest.
That's right, we're going to let John take us in and out of the episode. Welcome back.
Thank you. It is nice to be back on the podcast.
Yeah, it's nice to have you. I'm trying to think if we can make an Idaho joke to insult you properly. But I feel like, Brian, I feel like we could do better at Idaho jokes. There are so many low-hanging fruit there, and we just go with the, like, low potato tropes. We could do better.
Potato jokes? Oh, you can count on us. I mean, totally.
Gosh. Yeah, see, this is what we're working with here. Well, you know how I love Brigham Young and obviously believe everything he says.
You and me both.
Well, I mean, as everybody knows, he's got game. Right. Wait. Why do I have to be the one that says he has game? That's not fair.
I mean, that's the one thing I've taken away from this podcast is Brigham Young has game.
You know what? I'm going to punch you both in the face from Zoom, from far afar. Do not say that again. Brigham Young has no game. We all know that. I hope that we've illustrated that. And we haven't even gotten into the Utah period where I'm so excited to talk about all the ways that he was wrong.
Well, I look forward to it.
Okay. So speaking of which, on July 11th, 1852, Brigham Young stated in a speech that he was giving at the Salt Lake Tabernacle, quote, I know for myself that Joseph Smith was a subject of 48 lawsuits, and the most of them I witnessed with my own eyes, but not one action could ever be made to bear against him. No law or constitutional right did he ever violate. He was innocent and virtuous. He kept the law of his country and lived above it. Out of 48 lawsuits, and I was with him in most of them, not one charge could be substantiated against him. End quote. Okay, 48 lawsuits. He's above the law. Weird brag, Brigham. So is this true, John?
So, spoiler, absolutely not. But we're going to kind of get into that. But this doesn't stop with Brigham Young. So Fair Mormon, the Foundation for Apologetic Information and Research, who describes themselves as an organization that provides, quote, well-documented answers to criticisms of LDS doctrine, belief, and practice, also claim that Joseph Smith was never convicted of a crime. On their website, they host a speech that was given at one of their conferences by Joseph Bentley, a lawyer who worked on the Joseph Smith papers, legal volumes. And in this speech, Bentley states, quote, Joseph Smith was persecuted in courts of law as much as anyone I know, but he was never found guilty of any crime, and his name cannot be tarnished in that way. And just as an aside, we talked about this, if you remember, in episode 42, and he absolutely has been convicted of committing a crime.
And, you know, BYU studies, they always get in on these debates. And recently, well, I guess it's a couple of years ago, they published a book, Sustaining the Law, Joseph Smith's Legal Encounters, which discusses his interactions with law, obviously. And it discusses all of kind of the regularly debated legal cases. And in there, it makes a claim that, quote, he was never convicted of any criminal offense. Whenever he was given a fair hearing, he was found to be an upstanding and honest citizen.
Oh, I see what they did there. Did you hear the when given a fair hearing that gives himself a convenient out? It's you know, when he's convicted, it's because it was unfair. But when he wasn't convicted, it was a fair hearing.
You know, it's always nice when you get to define what isn't fair. So it works in your favor.
So that is one of the problems with this topic, with kind of Mormon legal history, is when people define, I guess, what is or isn't. And so, in fact, the whole discussion of Joseph Smith and the law sometimes can be somewhat silly.
Silly. Silly is such an Idaho word. Good work, Dana.
Silly is not an Idaho word.
You silly goose. Joseph Smith is such a silly goose.
That's what we say up here, yes. So maybe silly isn't the word I mean, but there seems to be a real lack of nuance when these legal issues are talked about. So one side will defend Joseph Smith like their life depends on it, not admitting to or allowing him to be human or make any mistakes. And the other side seems to argue that if he loses a legal argument, then he's all of a sudden a false prophet. And so to me, it's just, for both sides, sort of a weird hill to die on, because as a lawyer, I often see that there are two sides to events. And just because somebody does a really bad thing, that doesn't mean they're a bad person. But on the flip side, bad people also do really bad things. And so I love these topics because they're so interesting. But I also think that people need to kind of take a deep breath and wonder how much these things really matter, and sort of just sort of enjoy Mormon legal history.
So we got a lot of legal disputes dealing with Joseph Smith. Sadly, we won't have time for all of them tonight. But the big ones are the 1826 Glasslooker fraud case, Joseph Smith's 1834 assault case, the illegal marriages in Kirtland, and then, of course, the Kirtland bank fiasco. Then a little bit later, the conspiracy to commit murder, habeas corpus, a big one, the Lawrence estate, polygamy / adultery, sexual slander, the destruction of the Nauvoo Expositor, on and on and on. And most of these should sound familiar because we've talked about them in the past, but we'll talk about them more tonight. We'll talk about the legal aspects. We'll talk about them probably in greater detail.
Perfect. And those are just the ones where Joseph Smith was a party. He was also involved in trials as a judge and also was a justice of the peace. And so just as an aside, I mean, he was actually a decent judge. And in one case, he greatly expanded the rights of women in Nauvoo. Kind of weird.
That's why this is kind of fun or cool. I know all the cool kids are talking about habeas corpus these days. So hashtag habeas corpus.
Thank you. They are. So we can't hit all the topics, but we can hit some of them. And so let's start with the 1826 Glasslooker case, this sort of fraud case. And as I was kind of looking into this for this podcast, I found that the church actually has an article, like the Gospel Topic Essays, specifically on this case. And it's not the worst written article. It's actually kind of fair. So let me read part of what they say. So they say, in 1826, Josiah Stowell hired Joseph Smith to look for lost Spanish silver near the border of New York and Pennsylvania. Someone in the community, possibly a member of Stowell's extended family, accused Joseph of gazing into a stone to discover lost property. As a result, Joseph was ordered to appear before Justice of the Peace Albert Neely in Chenango County, likely on charges of disorderly conduct. His arrest appears to have been based on a statute in New York State outlawing, quote, pretending to discover where lost goods may be found, close quote. Four accounts describe the hearing, all of which suggest Joseph suffered no serious legal consequences in its aftermath. Other details vary and sometimes contradict each other. In this case, we have Joseph Smith was hired to dig for treasure, and he used a seer stone to help find it. And so a nephew of Stowell decided that this looked like fraud and reported it.
So this doesn't seem that different from like an abuse of vulnerable adult case today. Someone is like scamming or stealing grandpa or grandma's money. So a family member steps in and reports it. Is that right?
Exactly. But in fairness, there was really nothing to say that Stowell was not of sound mind. But honestly, in looking at this, I can't blame his nephew at all.
So really, to me, it sounds more like a nephew complaining about the guy in his uncle's upline for LuLaRoe tights. You know, the message is, hey, stop sending Uncle Fred all these dead fart leggings.
So that sounds more accurate. And in fact, when does the episode on treasure digging and MLMs come out?
Well, we're actually in the editing process right now. We're just waiting for Deanne to get her audio clip into us, and then we drop it.
Perfect.
Okay, so back to the glass liquor trial. Where is the controversy? What happened?
Okay, so this is what I'm kind of talking about earlier, the obsession about whether he was convicted or acquitted. And that's the controversy, where just looking at the case itself is, to me, so much more interesting, as we'll kind of talk about. I mean, Joseph Smith testifies on the stand that he looked in the seer stone. And so at the trial, there was evidence presented regarding Smith and treasure seeking. For example, Stowell, the victim, actually testified on behalf of Joseph Smith. And so here's what someone reported he testified to. Says that prisoner had been at his house something like 5 months, had been employed by him to work on a farm part of the time, that he pretended to have skill of telling where hidden treasure in the earth were by means of looking through a certain stone. That prisoner had looked for him sometimes, once to tell him about money buried in Bend Mountain in Pennsylvania, once for gold on Monument Hill, and once for a salt spring. And that he positively knew that the prisoner could tell and did possess the art of seeing those valuable treasures through the medium of said stone. That he found the, and then the word is illegible, but it's money or treasure. So he found the money at Bend and Monument Hill as prisoner represented it.
All right. So if we go back to the essay about this on the LDS Church website, they state, quote, in his testimony, Joseph readily agreed he had used his seer stone off and on to look for lost property, but he had given up the practice. It hurt his eyes, he said. He had never solicited such work and, quote, had always rather declined having anything to do with this business. The judge inspected the stone and questioned other witnesses, including Joseph's father, Joseph Smith Sr., and Joseph's employer, Josiah Stowell. Love that little detail that the judge inspected the stone. I mean, what was he looking for? I have to wonder if he puts in his hat and gives it a try. Reply hazy, try again.
Right. You know this judge said, you know the judge said, like, okay, we're taking a break, and went back to chambers and tried it out. I mean, he had to have.
How could you not? He like would find a rock outside and be like, what about this one? Maybe. Maybe this one's the lucky one.
Oh, he tries the Martin Harris. Oh, I'll just switch it out and see if he notices.
Absolutely. It's fascinating. And then what else to me is kind of cool is Joseph Smith saying he gave it up because it hurt his eyes. Like, he doesn't deny that this happened or that he has this gift. He says, I just quit because it hurt my eyes. So, you know, if anybody, you know, lets me see their seer stone, I'm going to take a peep. A peep? That's like a Lindsey Bryant level joke right there.
Don't.
Oh, that's the kind of joke that would kill down at the Mercantile. Absolutely.
Not drag me into that terrible pun. My puns are a lot more sophisticated than that.
Anyway, I'd take a peep. So back to the church's article.
That's the kind of puns you get from Idaho.
Absolutely, the best kind. So back to the church's article. Here's kind of what they conclude. The outcome of the hearing remains a puzzle. A purported court document record indicates the judge found Joseph guilty. A neighbor of Josiah Stowell claimed that the court condemned Joseph but allowed him to escape on account of his youth. A friend of the judge, who claimed to have taken notes at the hearing, wrote that the judge accepted Stowell's testimony and discharged Joseph. Oliver Cowdery, who did not attend the hearing, he met Joseph Smith about 3 years later, mentioned the most likely result in light of missing documentation, that Joseph was acquitted of being a disorderly person. And so I get a kick out of Oliver Cowdery because as a prosecutor, I get letters from family members all the time. Like, we'll have somebody on film stealing a car, and they write a letter to the judge saying he would never steal a car. He didn't steal the car. So, you know, Oliver Cowdery is still doing what they do today. So that's kind of the dispute. What happened? So the judge's notes published in 1873 state clearly, quote, "and therefore the court find the defendant guilty."
Okay, so I don't get it. That sounds pretty cut and dry to me. Where's the wiggle room here?
Okay, so 4 years later in 1877, another account of the trial was published. And in it, the person who watched the trial wrote, quote, "It is hardly necessary to say that as the testimony of Deacon Stoll could not be impeached, the prisoner was discharged and in a few weeks left the town," close quote.
Yeah, and so great, but don't you think that the judge's notes outrank this rando that watches the trial and then he writes about it a million years later?
So you would think so. And I agree. And so so this really kind of heats up in the 1970s. So historian Marvin Hill, he wrote in a BYU Studies article, "Joseph Smith and the 1826 Trial, New Evidence and New Difficulties." He writes about this. And this was a response to a guy named Wesley Walters. He did research on the Mormons back then. He was kind of a contemporary of, or maybe a little earlier, of the Tanners. So did that kind of type research, but he found some new documents in the case. And so the importance in the documents that this Wesley Walters found were that he found actual court documents that matched the judge's published recollection. And so it really backed up that he was in fact found guilty. And so Hill kind of looks at everything. He says there's contradictions and ultimately concluded that we just don't know. And it's a pretty good article. And then 2 years later, Walters actually officially published his article and the evidence, saying that it was absolutely a finding of guilt.
Okay, but this is why I get frustrated with this, because my understanding is that people really don't like the evidence that he found. And so instead of attacking the documents themselves, they try to attack things like the chain of custody, or like he took documents from where he was, you know, from somewhere that they weren't supposed to be, and basically applying legal standards of evidence of what he did. Is that wrong?
No, that's exactly right. As I understand, he found these in a basement of the courthouse, and he kind of like took them out of the file to say, "Hey, look what I found." And that's where people attack him. We can't trust that they're legitimate because of that. And it's really just, they didn't like. And then others have argued that it wasn't actually trial. It was something called a preliminary hearing, where a judge doesn't decide guilt or innocence, but he rather decides if there's probable cause or enough evidence for it to go on to a trial. And so, you know, we start getting this kind of stuff. And then one more article of note was Gordon Madsen in 1990, in a BYU Studies article. He argues that Smith was actually acquitted. So the debate kind of rages on, everybody taking a different point of view on this.
I'd never tell a man to ask my daddy for my hand. I've got a thousand tales about the temper of that man. He'd shoot a man who came within a mile of my young frame.
All right, yes, treasure digging is cool and sexy, but if it pleases the court, I propose we move on to some bank fraud.
All right, so the Kirtland Bank fiasco. And I know you guys covered this in episode 20, but let's sort of do it again, just with a little more legal context. So if you don't mind, let's kind of catch people up that didn't listen to episode 20 and the other people that are here for the hardcore legal analysis, aka the really cool people.
Okay, so the Kirtland Bank is possibly Joseph Smith's first large-scale disaster, right? This is like where he gets people to put stuff in, a lot of investment, and he really pisses off all of his friends. You know, you could argue that like a lot of things that go bad, this started with really good intentions, or did it? Anyway, money or currency was difficult to come by on the frontier. We sort of talked about this already. And so in 1836, Joseph Smith wants to start a bank in Kirtland. And like most of the things he did, he like turns it up to 11, jumps right in. He sent Orson Hyde to the Ohio legislature to get permission, and sent Oliver Cowdery to Philadelphia to order plates to start printing the money. They just like, it's go time. And one of those guys was successful and one was not. Hyde and the Saints were not given permission to start the bank.
Okay, but they have the plates. And so if you have plates, you're going to print money, right?
Why not? You and Joseph think alike. It must be something in the Idaho water. So this is not an anti-Mormon conspiracy. They were not given permission because the people in power in Ohio were Jacksonian Democrats who did not like banks issuing money or banks in general. Those Democrats, they liked hard currency, gold, silver, not some silly paper being passed around. So what the Saints did was use the word anti and apply that to the plates. So now they were the Kirtland Safety Society anti-banking company. Do you see what they did there? They aren't a bank. They're an anti-bank. If you don't want to form a bank because banks are bad, then you just do an anti-bank.
So I know a lot of bad is to come, but we just have to pause and realize how hilarious this really is. That they act just like a bank. They did everything they were planning to do, but they just simply added the word anti and think everybody is fooled. Kind of like when Superman puts on glasses and all of a sudden he's Clark Kent.
And this whole adding the anti thing is interesting. I kind of have to think it was a last-ditch effort because, I mean, I haven't seen a ton of these notes, but I've seen a decent amount, and you don't see them super often, but you do occasionally. And it's really fun when you do because, yeah, you can just see this little anti added in there. And it is funny because it's like, oh, just kidding, we're not a bank. All right, enough talk about physical notes for a minute. How did they actually fund them? So what would happen is the bank would issue notes or stock, and they weren't backed by gold, hard currency, but rather they were backed by Kirtland land that was there in the town. And that's not really a great idea, because if that land drops in value, then your notes do too. And if there's a crash, then they're just totally worthless. And the Mormons there in Kirtland go all in with land and with what little hard money that they did have.
So historians generally agree that this was just a terrible idea. So historian Robert Kent Fielding said, quote, as it was projected, there was never the slightest chance that the Kirtland Safety Society anti-banking company could succeed. Even though their economy was in jeopardy, it could scarcely have suffered such a devastating blow as that which they were themselves preparing to administer to it. Furthermore, total issuance of the notes was not prescribed, nor was the relation of notes to capital and assets. The members, to be sure, pledged themselves to redeem the notes and bound themselves individually by their agreement under the penal sum of $100,000. But there was no transfer of property deeds, no power of attorney, no legal pains and penalties. To a banker, the articles fairly shouted, "This is a wildcat, beware." And so here's the crazy thing. Even Fair thinks that this was a horrible idea. In writing about this, they say, quote, "The Kirtland Safety Society was an unwise venture and was probably illegal."
And that's saying something, because if Fair is like, it's probably legal, that means it is 100% legal. It's like me telling Lindsay, polygamy deniers are probably yelling at you on Facebook right now. Probably.
We got to pause for a minute and let me vent some frustration here, because Mormons are always like, no, we didn't break any laws. But then they'll be quick to brag about how Brigham and Joseph were so above the law. I mean, it says it in that quote I read earlier, like they're proud that they're above the law, but we never broke any law. It drives me crazy.
I'm with you.
Let me chime in something there too. Later on, you'll get things, I mean, much closer to our times, like they'll be interviewing folks from the FLDS, for example, like when Alan Steed goes on trial for marrying Elisa Wall, and they're talking to him in court. He flat out says, oh no, God's laws are above man's laws. And to our contemporary ears, that just sounds nutso. But that doesn't come out of nowhere. I mean, that idea goes back to this kind of thing, right? God's laws are better than man's laws. And so we're above whatever banking laws man comes up with.
Right. And look at people who sort of brag or take pride in their ancestor went to prison for polygamy. It's like a badge of honor.
Called out on that because I still think it's kind of adorable. There's something wrong with me. I'm like, oh yeah, grandpa in the striped pajamas. But you're absolutely right.
It's just the striped jammies. If they don't have those, all the charm goes away.
I mean, it's true. We have such a weird backward thing of like, what is, I mean, that's why we have all of us, you know about this, Dinger, up at the state capitol in Idaho all the time. We have all these like Mormons who are anti-government, but carrying an American flag all the time, because it's like, we're patriots, but only if the way that we think a law should be, it's protected by America.
Absolutely. And while you guys knock on Idaho, we still have our historic prison where we housed our polygamists that got sent there. So come up to Idaho.
We'll do a tour there. We've talked about it. We're talking about setting up a tour sometime and having Dinger take us to some cool spots. And it's near Boise, right?
It's in Boise. Cool. So yes, you guys need to come up and we will do the polygamy prison tour.
Okay. Well, sorry to get us off on the rant. We can go back to Kirtland.
All right. So after a few months of this anti-bank, there was a nationwide banking crisis. And so we've all seen this play out in the movie, It's a Wonderful Life, when the woman comes in and they want their cash out, and then some of them only take out what they need. But that's what happened here in the 1830s. The big banks quit dispersing gold and silver, which caused a run on all the banks, which in turn caused everything like land investments to go bad. And so the anti-bank blew up.
Okay, so then where does the whole lawsuit come into play for this?
Okay, so first there was a suit claiming that the bank was illegal and could not legally issue paper money. And there was an initial hearing where the court found enough evidence to go forward. And so rather than face trial, Smith and Rigdon were out of town that day. And so the court tried the case in absentia, meaning they went forward without the defendants there. And that is something I have not had the opportunity to do yet as a lawyer, but I've had a colleague that did, and it is wild. The woman showed up for the first day of trial and then said, I'm not coming for the rest. So that's kind of what they did. And so they were found guilty of illegal banking and fined $1,000 each. And then there were more lawsuits when creditors sued and started winning judgments. And then finally, a warrant was issued for bank fraud. And that's a serious, serious crime. And so that's when Smith and Rigdon didn't just go out of town for the day, but they fled to Missouri. And so a lot of the disputes regarding this weren't whether he was convicted or not, but rather the disputes legally are kind of, was there fraud? Did Joseph enrich himself? You know, did he have bad motives when he set up this bank? And so a lot of this kind of got stirred up by Fawn Brody in her book, No Man Knows My History. In there, she claimed that investors were duped by Smith, that there were boxes filled with sand and other precious metals that were marked, you know, $1,000 on them. So when investors went in there, they could kind of heft the boxes, look at them, and believe that the bank was backed with precious metals. And so in fairness, Brody didn't make this up. She cited a guy named Oliver Olney and some others. And he was just this fascinating guy who, I hate using this word, but apostatized in Nauvoo. So he wasn't the most friendly. Well, he wasn't friendly.
Okay, so didn't this, though, lead to another legal issue, if you will? Didn't it lead to Joseph Smith conspiring to have someone murdered?
Yes. So the Granderson Newell case. So Granderson Newell was this wealthy non-Mormon in Kirtland, and he didn't really like the competition. And so I saw on Reddit that someone compared him to Mr. Burns from The Simpsons, and that just seemed spot on. And so he did encourage these people to file the lawsuits against Smith because of the anti-banking fiasco. And so Granderson Newell, there in the 1830s, he accused Smith of conspiring with a Solomon Denton and a Marvel C. Davis to murder him because he got involved in, you know, the Kirtland Safety Society and having people sue Smith. And so this case went to preliminary hearing. And like we talked about earlier, that's just a hearing to see if there's enough evidence to go forward. And two apostles testified. And so can you imagine that happening today? Two apostles testifying against the prophet. And so one of those was Orson Hyde, who testified that, quote, Smith seemed much excited and declared that Newell should be put out of the way or where the crows could not find him. He said destroying Newell would be justifiable in the sight of God, that it was the will of God, close quote. And then Luke Johnson, one of the forgotten apostles, he testified similarly, but kind of put a caveat on it. He sort of added, quote, that Smith said, quote, if Newell or any other man should head a mob against him, they ought to be put out of the way, and it would be our duty to do so. So he said, you know, it was more talking about a Smith a mob coming on them. And then Denton, he testified as well. Denton was, again, one of the guys who was supposed to commit the murder. And he said that he and Davis were supposed to murder Newell. Denton said that Smith said that Newell, quote, had injured the society and that it was better for one man to suffer than to have the whole community disturbed. That it is the will of heaven that Newell should be put out of the way and that he would take responsibility for the deed was justifiable in the sight of God and would be rewarded. But when he had killed him, he wanted his body secreted as possible. And so here's my question for you guys, that it is better for one man to suffer than to have a whole community disturbed. Does that sound like a Book of Mormon story to you guys?
Jeez, I was just going to say, where have I heard that? That's the thing that makes it ring true for me.
We just talked about this at the top of the episode. Like, I believe that that scripture has done more harm writ large in Mormonism than any other scripture. It needs to go. It spawns fundamentalist violence. It's just the thinking alone is so backward and dangerous.
Yeah. And I'm with you, Brian. Well, I'm with both of you, but Brian, yeah, when I read that, I was like, huh, this sounds familiar. But anyway, so even though it was bound over or there was enough evidence to go forward, 6 days later, the court dismissed the charges and it was let go.
And can I just say, if anyone ever does a biography of Grandison Newell, can we title it "The Crows Could Not Find Him"? I mean, that's... Please.
Yeah, but can we have Moira from Schitt's Creek be in it somehow? Because I just... she needs to be in any movie with the title of Crows.
I agree.
Yeah, no, this is so crazy. This is why, like, legal history sounds boring, but it's insane.
Right. And so if you honestly think about it, all these true crime podcasts that are so popular are actually just legal history podcasts. However, we've been dabbling. It is now time to go full nerd.
Oh, that's my favorite kind of nerd, but it has to be while wearing a nerd hat, obviously.
We do have nerd hats. Dinger, we need to send you a nerd hat, some Mormon History Podcast nerd hat.
I'll take it.
Okay, so does that mean it's time for habeas corpus? Which, first question, for those who have not listened to the other episodes, what is habeas corpus?
Okay, so I'm going to give you the nerd answer, then the real person answer. So nerd answer, habeas corpus is a legal proceeding having its origin in British common law, in which an individual being held in custody can contest the legality of the detainment. The prisoner or someone in his behalf may ask a court or an individual judge for a writ of habeas corpus. After a writ was issued, the prisoner would be brought before the issuing judge to determine whether the hold was legal. This was usually done by determining whether the process of issuing an arrest warrant or extradition order was done correctly. So the normal person answer is, you get arrested, you file a motion for a writ of habeas corpus, which forces the person jailing you to bring you in front of a judge. And then you get to say, hey, judge, I'm being detained illegally. And the judge decides. And if you are, he lets you go. If not, you go back to jail.
I got to say, I like the nerd answer better. I suppose that's because I have a hat. But you know, so what? Habeas corpus, everybody had it. Why is this such a controversy in Nauvoo then?
Okay. Fair question. And it's because the saints pushed it to its limit and then a bit more. And so I'm going to say something that a lot of people will think is crazy, but here it goes. Habeas corpus is one of the main reasons Joseph Smith was murdered. In fact, I would argue it is the main reason.
Not polygamy?
Not polygamy.
All right. I'm going to let you make your case. But first, you talked about how they pushed the limits of habeas corpus. Can you explain how saints pushed it to its limit?
Absolutely. So usually if you're arrested, right, or in custody, and you file for a writ of habeas corpus, the judge looks at the document or the writ or the arrest warrant that put you in custody. Is it legally done? So in Nauvoo, they kept passing laws making it more and more liberal. And so it got to the point where the Nauvoo courts would go beyond determining if just the warrant was legal, but would decide if a warrant or arrest should have been made in the first place. Like, did you even commit a crime?
Objection, Your Honor. Counselor's beating around the bush here. What's our specific case? Sounds like you're talking about Missouri. This is the Lilburn Boggs assassination attempt, right?
So this is like when they would come to arrest Joseph Smith, he would file for a writ to be taken in front of a friendly Mormon judge. He would pull the habeas corpus card, and then the judge wouldn't look and see if the warrant was valid, but would decide that he didn't have anything to do with the assassination attempt and let Joseph Smith go, right?
Bingo. And so that's exactly right. And it was kind of done by degrees, but it ultimately got there. And so while this kind of sounds shady, the United States Supreme Court eventually did the same thing. So in 1953, the Supreme Court, so roughly 100 years later, found that federal courts could examine the constitutionality of a state criminal conviction, greatly expanding the strength of the writs of habeas corpus. And so again, this is what Nauvoo was doing nearly 100 years before. And so when the Supreme Court did this in 1953, habeas corpus kind of became known as the Great Writ. But we have, you know, people in Nauvoo doing it 100 years before. And so for all the listeners, that's why when you see Lindsay wearing a hat that says "Make habeas corpus great again," a red hat, she's referring to that Great Writ.
I'm wearing it right now. How did you know?
Well, it's kind of a nerd hat, but not quite.
And something else that I was looking at today, in addition to, you know, the way that they do it, it seems like the number of times that they do it. So the stats that I was looking at indicated that during this time, between federal and state writs of habeas corpus, you were talking like 15 a year, I mean, countrywide. And in Nauvoo, they do about that number over the case of just a couple of years, just in Nauvoo. So I think part of it too seems like it's numbers, isn't it?
Yeah, they loved it and they used it when they could.
All right. So as they're doing this, are they just being innovative, you know, like they were with, say, something like marriage, or is it something more?
So they probably had the authority to do it. They certainly had the authority to do habeas corpus, to pass habeas corpus acts. It's just, did they push it a little far? And so this is also something that you guys have discussed, but the authority for this came from the Nauvoo Charter. And so the Nauvoo Charter was similar to many other cities in Illinois, but whoever wrote Nauvoo's, and I know that John C. Bennett had a hand in it, but I don't know if it was him, but whoever helped write this and draft this slipped in the authority to pass laws regarding habeas corpus.
Right. No other Illinois town allowed for granting of habeas corpus. So whoever did that was pretty smart.
Yes. And so as you track the different habeas corpus laws passed in Nauvoo, you see that they track with Joseph Smith's arrest.
Interesting how that lines up. If I'm remembering this right, his first arrest for all of this was early in June of 1841. So Nauvoo period. Smith was visiting Governor Carlin in Quincy, who had been sent a warrant from Missouri requesting the arrest of Smith. And he didn't tell Smith any of this, but after he left, he sent a posse to arrest him.
Right. I mean, it's bad manners to arrest someone in your home, right? So anyway, he was arrested in Quincy and he was brought before a magistrate. And when he was in front of that judge, he files a writ of habeas corpus. And so he was brought before a district judge, and there happened to be one in Quincy, a Judge Stephen A. Douglas. And can I give a quick side note, an apology to Illinois about Stephen A. Douglas? Is that okay?
The court will allow it.
Okay. I once wrote an article that was eventually published. And in it, I referred to Stephen A. Douglas of the Lincoln-Douglas debates fame. And reviewer number two was somebody from Illinois, and they lost their mind that is what I put about Stephen A. Douglas. I imagine had I said that at a conference, this person would have come up and punched me in the face.
Why?
So to all,
why
I don't know. I don't know. But I mean, he was more impressive than just someone who debated Lincoln. But boy, they took it serious. So to anybody from Illinois, I officially apologize, and especially to reviewer number two.
Those are fighting words all the way up from dusty, cold Idaho.
Well, and, you know, our apologies to reviewer too, but unless you live in Illinois, that's like the only reason you mainly have heard of him. I mean, yeah, he's not as famous as he would later become with the debates. And, you know, had he not been going against the other half of that phrase, Lincoln, he may have become president. But, you know, and Douglas, we talk about him a lot. He wasn't actually Mormon, but for the most part, he's generally friendly and he had actually helped them get the charter passed. But, you know, I sure hope he doesn't change his mind about Mormons down the road. That would be bad.
That would be bad. So Douglas, he held a hearing and found that the warrant sent by Missouri had expired. And so if they wanted Smith, they had to send a fresh one, a valid one. So he basically did habeas corpus as everybody else did. He discharged Smith, sent him on his way. And so the important thing here is Smith learned that Mormons had a powerful legal device at their disposal, which they could be that they could use to thwart their enemies using the legal system, something that they had never been able to do before. And so because of this introduction to habeas corpus, that's when the Nauvoo City Council kind of started going hog wild and passing more expansive versions. And so in all, they passed six ordinances dealing with habeas corpus. And again, they kind of tracked the arrests. And so at first they're normal and mundane, but as they kept going, they kept getting more and more creative. For example, they passed a law that if you asked for one, you had to be you had to be brought before the Nauvoo Municipal Court. You couldn't take them to any other judge. It had to be the Nauvoo Municipal Court.
It has to be right at home. They basically mandated the home court advantage.
Exactly. And then they also put in the section that if you were serving a warrant for the purpose of harassment, you could be fined $1,000 and serve 1 year in jail.
I'm guessing they considered trying to arrest Joseph Smith for the whole Missouri Boggs assassination thing harassment?
Yeah, that's exactly it. And they passed a double jeopardy type law as well, that if you've been discharged on a particular crime by habeas corpus, you can't be arrested on it again. But then in December of 1843, they dropped all pretext and they passed a law entitled Special Ordinance in the Prophet's Case versus Missouri. And this ordinance said, quote, if any person or persons shall come with process, demand, or requisition founded upon the aforesaid Missouri difficulties to arrest said Joseph Smith, he or they so offending shall be subjected to arrest by any officer of the city, with or without process, and tried by the municipal court upon testimony, and if found guilty, sentenced to imprisonment in the city prison for life, which convict or convicts can only be pardoned by the governor with the consent of the mayor of said city.
And that is just amazing, because the governor has to come and beg Joseph Smith's permission to pardon somebody. But I mean, like, if you name yourself the lieutenant general, I mean, that's just kind of part of your stick.
And chancellor of Nauvoo University. Don't forget, Brian.
Yes, yes. The very powerful. I mean, they had a good football team, but.
Well, thankfully, the city council comes to their senses, because on February 12th, 1844, without giving a reason, the city council repealed the special ordinance, deciding to rely on their creative habeas corpus to protect Smith rather than this likely unconstitutional ordinance.
Yeah. And so either way, non-Mormons started getting fed up. So the Davenport Gazette, a newspaper there in the area, reported that Smith's ability to elude the law. They stated how Smith obtained a writ of habeas corpus in the Boggs case, and the trial resulted in his discharge. And the same paper also, in regard to Smith's untouchable status, stated that he was, quote, protected by that immaculate body, the Nauvoo Municipal Court. And so the people of Carthage, they also reported on this, and it was reported that they denounced Joe Smith as the most foul-mouthed blackguard that was ever commissioned by Satan to vex and torment the children of men, and repeating the grievances which they have suffered, declared that there is no alternative now left but to repeal every indignity or oppression offered by the Mormons at the point of the bayonet, close quote.
I just love 19th century language. The most foul-mouthed blackguard. This is great. So yeah, the Nauvoo Expositor, we're going to do two episodes just on that. But in discussing that, it also pulls in habeas corpus, because in that single issue of the Expositor, one of the main complaints that they raised was all of these habeas corpus acts that have been passed, and as a consequence, Joseph Smith's ability to just evade the law.
Hashtag habeas corpus. Okay, so more than that, Smith used habeas corpus to get out of trouble. When the city council destroyed the press, for example, that we're going to be talking about, declaring it to be a nuisance, the owners complained and Smith was arrested. But guess what he did? He pulled out his habeas corpus card and was going to be tried in Nauvoo. So Daniel H. Wells, a non-Mormon, although pro-Mormon, acquitted Smith on June 17th.
Yeah. And so this acquittal, which was because of habeas corpus, outraged non-Mormons in the surrounding area and throughout the state of Illinois in general. And so while both sides of the conflict started to prepare for a coming conflict, Governor Ford went to Carthage to defuse the situation. And while there, he demanded that Smith come to Carthage to be tried for the crime again, but by a neutral judge. So again, it really was the view that he was untouchable by the law that so angered everyone. It wasn't polygamy. It wasn't the Book of Mormon. It was habeas corpus. And so there have been some back and forth between scholars on these issues. Dallin H. Oakes actually published an article on habeas corpus back in the 60s, and it wasn't specifically Nauvoo, it was just kind of habeas corpus in general, and it's actually a really good article for, you know, hardcore legal nerds. But then in 2009, things started to really heat up. Morris Thurston published a BYU Studies article on the Boggs shooting and attempted extradition, Joseph Smith's most famous case, and it was really good, and it was the first article in a long time to talk about the extradition and the use of habeas corpus. And then I followed that up with Joseph Smith and the development of habeas corpus in Nauvoo, 1841 to 1844, in the Journal of Mormon History in 2010. And then after that, we get articles, mainly by apologists, arguing that, you know, Smith did nothing wrong and everybody else did.
I love that you guys are bragging about how many boring Nauvoo legal papers that you've all written, you and Dallin H. Oakes, and all your boring legal stuff. Wait, we just figured out Nauvoo legal history isn't boring, thanks to John Dinger. And speaking of that, we talked about theft and violence already. So Dinger, please tell me that in my attempt to change my thinking about legal history being boring, that we have some sex and scandal coming up.
Absolutely. That is what's next. Let's wrap it up with a sexual scandal.
You won't even look my way. Is there nothing I can say to make us how we used to be? You won't even notice me. Tell me what came over you to make you act so untrue.
You said so I sort of talked about this before when I was on the show. But let's sort of get into the legal weeds. This to me is really fun. Hopefully it is to other people. But on May 24th, 1844, the Hancock grand jury indicted Joseph Smith on the crimes of adultery and fornication. And the two witnesses were William and Wilson Law. But what makes this even more interesting is that two Mormons, William Marks and Edward Hunter, were on the grand jury. And then also on the grand jury was that Mormon friend, Daniel H. Wells. And so unless anything has changed since I last saw both of you, we can all agree that Joseph Smith had sex with some of his plural wives, or had plural wives, period. Because we, along with our friend John Hatch, we did a two-part podcast on this on the year of polygamy some years ago. But has anything changed? Anything you guys want to tell me?
John, are you not familiar with The Secret Chamber? Deep in the caverns of Hogwarts, you got Brigham Young, Heber C. Kimball. They're getting all Voldemort-y. They make up polygamy and this grand conspiracy to kill Joseph Smith. Hello?
And I just want to point out, all those listening, whenever they're like, I heard some anti-polygamy deniers be like, you know what? Lindsay's really smart when it comes to the Utah period, but we shouldn't listen to anything she has to say on Nauvoo because she doesn't really know it. Fine, fair. I'm a dummy when it comes to Nauvoo, but you know who isn't? John Dinger. And you know what John Dinger just said on this podcast? He thinks there was some sex going on and some polygamy going on as well. So there.
There we have it. So Smith is indicted on five counts, specifically with Maria Lawrence and, quote, certain women to the jurors unknown. So the legal dispute that occurred here is sort of fun and ultimately doesn't matter. But in the book that we mentioned at the beginning, that Sustaining the Law, there is an article by an M. Scott Bradshaw that argues that Joseph Smith did not commit a crime, specifically that what he did was not fornication or adultery.
I'm sorry, what?
What you talking about there, Dinger?
So when this article first came out, I had a real problem with it. But honestly, as I looked deeper, I actually really like this article. And I don't like all his conclusions. And he has some problematic stuff in there, like they should have checked Maria medically to see if she was a virgin. But nonetheless, it's worth reading. And so he takes the adultery and fornication statute and argues that they didn't apply to the situation. So at the time in Nauvoo, the 1833 statute prohibited, in quote, any man and woman who shall live together in an open state of adultery or fornication, or adultery and fornication. And so it declared the punishment to this would be a fine not exceeding $200 each and imprisonment not exceeding 6 months. And so the crime could be proved by circumstances which raise the presumption of cohabitation and unlawful intimacy.
Okay, I don't love the checking for a virgin thing. Don't love that at all. But what is he, I don't understand what he's arguing here, that it wasn't open, that they didn't cohabitate. If the laws and others knew about it, is that enough to show that it was open? Because people knew something was going on.
Okay, so yeah, that's the basic argument, that it wasn't open. And so that's where it's kind of fun. The term open wasn't defined by the statute, and it also didn't have a specific definition under the common law. And so while the 1833 statute mentions open and the presumption of cohabitation, there was an earlier case in 1825, Stegall versus Stegall, that kind of discusses this issue. And that's what we do in the law, right? We look back to other cases to see how they help us apply with what we're doing now. And so in Stegall, a woman sued to recover her dower and her share of her ex-husband's land. So adultery became an issue in the case, and the judge stated, quote, "I am much inclined to think, be satisfied by an open state of adultery, whether the woman resided in the same house with her adulterer or in separate houses, whether in her own or a friend's house or in his, whether with or without the ceremony of marriage," close quote. So in 1825, they weren't using the 1833 statute yet, and so it didn't require open as an element. The statute just simply said, it is highly injurious to the civilized society that men and women should live in adultery or fornication together. But however, this Stegall case is really important because it does help us with the definition of open. In this case, the judge clearly holds that adultery can be open regardless of cohabitation.
All right. So case closed. Based on Stegall here, it was open. See what I did there?
Yes.
Wait, can I just say that all this open, closed, adultery, marriage stuff is triggering me about ex-Mormons right now. I just want to throw that out there. Everyone has an open marriage when you're an ex-Mormon. Not that there's anything wrong with that. Just don't pull your habeas corpus card. Back to the conversation.
All right. So, Brian, I agree. The Stegall case does, but not so fast. Because then in 1852, there was this case, Searles versus the People of Illinois, where the court further explained what an open state of fornication was. So Asa Searles and Amanda Headley were indicted for living together in an open state of fornication. And Searles was tried by a jury. And at the trial, the court was then very clear on what was required under the statute. It held that, quote, "In order to constitute this crime, the parties must dwell together openly and notoriously upon terms as if the conjugal relation existed between them. In other words, they must cohabit together," close quote. And so the court went on to kind of talk about the purpose of the statute. And the purpose of the statute was to prohibit the public scandal and disgrace of the living together of persons of opposite sexes notoriously in illicit intimacy, which outrages public decency, having a demoralizing and debasing influence upon society. And so the court said, a single instance of illicit intercourse surely would not constitute the crime of living together in an open state of fornication, but that unlawful intimacy and cohabitation had to be proved for the crime of adultery and fornication.
This is so wild. Okay, so under Searles, he might not be guilty, except that he totally is because he did cohabitate. She lived in his house and then she was kicked out by Emma.
Okay, so I agree. And this is where it becomes interesting to me. So the Stegall case was in 1825, and then we get the Searles case in 1852. And so when did the change happen, right? Because this is 1844. It's right in between. So we're in this gray area where we get to argue it all out.
Okay, so where do you land on it then?
Okay, so hold on. There is one more Illinois case that I think is pretty interesting. So in Davis v. Davis, a case that was decided in 1857, the court again discussed cohabitation and the crime of adultery. And in this case, David Davis sued his wife, Louisa Davis, for divorce. And the Davises were married in 1840 and cohabitated for 13 years in Chicago. And in 1853, Louisa left the marriage, claiming that David had been guilty of adultery between the years of 1848 and 1852, in which there was a birth of a bastard child. And so in answering these charges, David did not deny the adultery, but claimed that it could not be used against him in the divorce due to a legal doctrine of condemnation, or that she was aware of the adultery and forgave him of it. And so while the case mainly deals with divorce and condemnation, the discussions of adultery are very applicable to how Joseph Smith's polygamous unions were carried out in Nauvoo, or at least some of them. In factually describing David's adultery, the court stated, quote, "The proofs in this cause show that for a series of years, respondent had a concubine and her child, of which he was the father, in his house, making part of his family circle. That the complainant knew this, and though they frequently quarreled about it, she was submissive and seemed to betray no concern. The caresses which were her due were lavished upon a wanton."
That's quite seedy, seedy language. Okay, so condemnation seems gross. Women didn't have the same power, legal or economic, you know, opportunities or status or protections as men back then.
Okay, so you would have made a great member of the Illinois Supreme Court in the 1850s.
Thank you. Do you hear that, Joseph Smith polygamy deniers? Nauvoo legal historian expert John Dinger not only thinks I'm decent at Nauvoo, but I could make a good judge back then.
You could. You should have been on the Illinois Supreme Court in the 1850s because they thought the same thing. They rejected this condemnation argument and held, quote, "It is true. Great allowances must be made for a mother under the circumstances in which she is often placed. She has not the same power of immediate and resolute actions as a father has. He has by law the custody and control of the children and of the estate, and is by nature better qualified to take prompt measures to vindicate his honor. On discovering his wife's infidelity, he can remove himself and his children beyond her reach and from all intercourse with her, and on the instant institute legal proceedings, nor do his friends desert him in such an emergency. Not so with the mother who has discovered her husband's faithlessness." And so what do you guys think? Adultery or not? Looking at all of it together, I say adultery.
Of course not, because this is the new and everlasting covenant. All right. I'm putting my serious hat on here. It's like my nerd hat, only it's black. So if you look at it in the eyes of the law, I think I land with maybe. I mean, I don't know. It's funny because, like, you look at all the language and it involves dwelling and cohabitation. And it's like, yeah, I mean, you look at the Nauvoo mansion there and it fits, but. You know, I mean, you really don't hear much beyond talk of occasional quickies, which, of course, these are the higher law kind. But, you know, as we've talked about, too, there's this shift in the legal reasoning that's happening right around him the whole time. But then if we just say sucks to the law entirely, then yes, absolutely. And that's the thing is, unless you're within this very particular kind of a theological framework, absolutely has to be.
My overall take on all of this is just like the amount and extent to which people, but Mormons specifically, will go to argue about how to make sex between two adults, or sometimes not adults, you know, okay or not okay. Like, we're just always organizing around it. And this whole like cohabitation thing, this argument is so interesting to me because it really comes to play in the Utah period, when they're trying to bust our grandfathers in our striped pajamas for similar laws, which, you know, don't even get me started how that applies to Nauvoo. Yeah. I mean, adultery, I don't like that word because I feel like it's a legal thing, but it's also a moral thing. But I'm going to side with you, Dinger. You're the expert.
Well, I appreciate that. An expert is a little generous, but thank you. But that's all I have today. But thank you.
Brian, how many books does he have that you sell at your store?
Well, you've got your fancy sitting high council minutes, and you've got your significant textual changes. So I think
I didn't even know you did that, Dinger. That's what a bad friend I am. That's a huge undertaking.
Thank you. So I haven't published, no books lately, but lots of articles. But this whole debate, this was it adultery, fornication, all that, I am going to have a chapter published in a book with signature books coming up, discussing all of this. So
this is the one that Cheryl Bruno is editing.
Correct.
That is going to be a fantastic book. There's lots of good stuff.
Yeah. We'll have to bring you guys on to talk about that. Okay. So basically, is Brigham Young right then? There were all these cases. Joseph Smith's a criminal. Is that our takeaway today? Cause that's my takeaway.
So my takeaway is we need to apply nuance. And when we do that, he was convicted of crimes. He was found civilly liable for things. But, you know, let's take a big picture and enjoy it for what it is and not assign too much more than what it actually is, court cases.
Are you talking to me? Is that directed at me because of my previous comment? I stand by it. We're all criminals. Habeas corpus. Forever.
Make habeas corpus great again.
Well, thanks so much, Dinger, for coming on again and allowing us to make fun of you. It's just the joy of my heart. And for discussing all these smart things.
Anytime.
Honor, if it please the court, we would like to introduce Exhibit A, tonight's Books of Mormon report. All right, on the book side, you have Sustaining the Law, which is largely done by first-generation Joseph Smith Papers guys. And speaking of the Joseph Smith Papers, one more plug to check out the Legal series on their website. And I say website because, sadly, nothing is going to appear in print. On the article side, Mr. John Dinger, who graced us with his digital presence earlier, has written some fantastic stuff. The best way to do it is go to check out his academia page for the list of his articles. And speaking of Dinger, and honestly, who isn't tonight? His edited volume, The Nauvoo City and High Council Minutes from the good folks at Signature, includes a lot of the nuts and bolts on this topic.
Brother Brigham, Brother Young, won't you sin destroying day nights, Brother Young? Spill my blood upon the earth, oh Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I beg you, spill my blood, oh Brother Young. And let it smoke ascend to heaven, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. And let my breast be cut asunder, Brother Young. As an offering for my sins, a smoking incense, Brother Young. A blood atoning for my sinning, Brother Young. Cause I sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I sinned so gravely, Brother Young. That only you can save me, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. But only
the song you heard today is called Brother Brigham, Brother Young by an artist, Corb Lund. Check out his music at corblund.com. And consider giving a donation to sunstone.org to support this podcast.